you know, it's sad because we are, you know, globally we're seen as the world's best mining jurisdiction. This is why you guys have your podcast. And we should be for uranium. So my highest probability is that the policy gets changed when there's a change of government. That's most likely.
Yeah.
I think the second thing is that there can be change of policy when Mr. Cook could read the room, kind of like he read the room on the ridiculous heritage laws and the about face that was done on that. If he sees that indeed it is truly this mining ban is unpopular in the community, and it might cost him votes in the next election, you know, you could possibly see a move on that.
Righto, JD, we're getting into the yellow cake.
Sure,
I like, mate. I like the bloody yellow cake. This is, it's, mate, it's flying at the moment.
So we've got a bit of a different chat in store today, don't we? We're going to focus specifically on uranium mining in WA and more broadly in Australia, as well as talking quite a bit about nuclear generation and what the laws are around nuclear power generation in Australia.
We had Jono Fisher, CEO of Cauldron Energy, is becoming a bit of an activist, you'd say, against the WA government to try and get WA mining back going. It's a bloody ripping chat. It was very, very informative, and I reckon she'll go mad on Twitter, mate. So let's get into it. For the sponsors for today, our great friends, the RC Drilling Experts at K-Drill. Look, mate, K-Drill, they're not fucking scared of uranium. Right, Ron O'Sullivan puts it on his toast, mate. They will drill for uranium and any other bloody commodity out there. So
that's it. You need RC Drillers. Get in touch with the guys at K-Drill.
And make sure you drop our name. When you do get in touch with them, it'll help the relationship. So cheers, K-Drill, for all your support. So righto, let's get into our WA mining of uranium chat and nuclear power generation in Australia with Jono Fisher. Here we go. Jono Fisher, CEO of Cauldron Energy, mate, and part-time news article journalist, it appears too, mate.
Hey, Cobber,
you're christening, you've popped the cherry of the office. You're the first in-person interview.
Let's do it.
Exciting. Mate, look, as I said, pretty timely that we're doing this one today. Look, the basis of this chat is uranium mining in Australia, specifically WA, and I'm sure we might get into nuclear power generation a bit as well. Mm. Two separate issues. Will they be intertwined? We're about to find out. And look, uranium is, it's all talk at the moment. We've seen the uranium spot price, I know it gets quoted different everywhere, roughly risen from what, $49 a pound US to today we saw one thing saying 65. Sweden recently announced
71 overnight.
71.
It keeps going up, mate.
It's bloody every website's different, I've found. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we'll run with 71 because you know a shitload more about uranium than I do. We recently talked about Sweden, how they announced plans to lift that parliamentary ban on uranium mining and build at least 10 new reactors. You've got Japan bringing on new nuclear reactors after they had a big pause after Fukushima. So why not get the man at the bloody, mate, you're trying to, I see, make a difference in uranium mining, but leveraged off your company a bit, but, you know, and you've had a pretty decent history in nuclear as well to this date. Haven't you?
Yeah, look, thanks. I do have a bit of a background from days gone by in the UK. And, you know, it's something that nuclear is a technology that is the best place to provide baseload power on a zero carbon megawatt hours basis. And it's something that has a track record in Australia, which is a bit patchy. And, you know, there's a lot of people in Australia that all these anti-nuclear people, they go, oh, well, but no one wants it. And I accept that was something that was probably right in the 1980s and, you know, Rainbow Warrior and Chernobyl and stuff like that was sort of the go. But today we've got a new generation of Australians and we have a concern about net zero. And people, you know what, people just want to get to net zero and they are passionate about it. And actually the view on nuclear has moved from the 1980s, yet it's something that the anti-nuclear campaigners can't accept. And they just keep saying, oh, well, no one wants it. You're like, well, look at the polling. There are multiple polls out there, including very left-leaning woke polls from the ABC, who are highly supportive of removing the nuclear ban federally and the uranium mining ban in WA.
Jono, how much has that momentum changed in the last year alone? Can you really feel it changing under our feet?
You know, we've got one of the largest deposits in WA, and we could drill it more, but actually people were saying, look, because of the current uranium mining ban, don't bother spending money on the ground in WA. because, you know, there's better places to spend your money. Right now, I am absolutely being inundated to say drill, drill, drill in WA, increase your resource, even though it's massive, because investors are going to like that. And that's driven by nuclear renaissance overseas. That is hugely, hugely the topic of the day. And we talked about spot price. Spot price has gone. Spot price continues to run, and every day it's up a couple more bucks. It will continue to do so, by the way, my hashtag higher for longer. and, you know, you're seeing that now flow through into the Aussie mainstream. And yes, it helps that Mr. Dutton and the Liberals look like they're taking a nuclear policy to the next election, but I would be at pains to say that's a great thing for Australia to consider for its future generation needs. It is related but separate to the uranium mining ban in WA, and we can actually prosecute and get rid of this uranium mining ban in WA quickly and without necessarily a need for Australian reactors.
Is that price rise going to be a bit of a hindrance if it rises too much, because then they're like, oh, it's not as cheap as everyone's claiming?
No, so, and this is the beauty about uranium, right? The costs of uranium to the operating cost of a nuclear reactor are poofteenth, right? So it's not like coal. So the demand curve from the utilities is highly inelastic. They don't really care, honestly, how much they pay for it. Yet if they don't get it and they have to shut a reactor down, that's very bad.
Yeah, right.
Right? So they are absolutely incentivized to get uranium. And uranium is traded either on term basis or in the spot market. And what we've seen recently is a lot of worry from people that are reliant on spot that they won't be able to get it. And you've had, you know, two big events recently is that BHP out of Olympic Dam have traditionally sold into spot. They haven't termed it. They've just swapped that out. So they are now going to term, which means there's millions of pounds coming out of spot. The second thing is literally overnight, it's sort of been made known, and there's a report from RBC on it, that Russia is now short uranium. Russia is looking around the spot market for pounds. That should spook every uranium short out there, because Russia's assumed, you know, with its sort of nuclear history, Russia's assumed to be self-sufficient on uranium. They're looking for spot. And the other thing is you've had obviously the invasion of Ukraine, and there's this bifurcation in the market, east versus west. You've had the African revolution in Niger, and you've had the Sprott Uranium Trust. Sprott is a physical holder of uranium, and until literally like last week, it's traded at below net asset value. What has happened now is it's now trading above net asset value. It means it issues more units and physically buys uranium and holds it, which means it takes it out of the spot market. And what does that do? It drives price.
Yeah.
So, mate, higher for longer, absolutely.
Jono, you've given us so much to work off there. I want to start with what the sort of state of play is with mining uranium in Australia, and then sort of state by state.
Yeah.
So why don't you break it down first?
Mining in Australia is governed, it's a state issue. The export of the uranium is a federal issue, right? So there is a federal aspect to play, but it's generally state-based. Queensland and WA are basically no. The Territory and South Australia are open. With respect to WA, you know, Mr. McGowan in all his wisdom in 2017 introduced a ban, and that is along party lines, obviously. He grandfathered in four projects into the regime. So those projects are already approved. He wouldn't stop. We were basically the fifth, so we just missed out. So you can imagine that we are very highly motivated to get that policy change.
What was it before that? Was it was there a limit on the amount of uranium mined before he put that total ban in?
No. So the Liberal government had opened up uranium exploration and mining, although there hasn't been a commercial scale uranium mining in WA. But previous Labor governments had banned it. So it has traded, you know, kind of along party lines. And it will do so again as soon as that government changes, that policy changes.
And the other states?
Well, South Australia has a long history of successful mining of uranium, you know, through BHP and Olympic Dam especially. And Boss Energy over there, Duncan Crabe is running Boss at the Honeymoon Project. They're restarting that. That is fantastic for the country.
Well, look, was it $1.3 billion market cap?
So 1.6 this morning. 1.6,
yeah, so yeah. Uranium's an interesting – because of what we find in a regulatory regime in Australia, you know, we don't consider ourselves competitors to Duncan. Actually, we want him and Boss to do well, because that helps the entire industry, because it shows that you can mine it safely. it's sad because we are, you know, globally we're seen as the world's best mining jurisdiction. I mean, this is why you guys have your podcast. And we should be for uranium. And we've got heaps of reserves. We've got ISL assets which can be developed. There are other, you know, stakeholders that are keen for this to happen, yet we've got an antiquated ban which needs to be lifted.
And what about Northern Territory and Queensland? I know they've both had historic uranium mines. We just had, was it Ranger just
Ranger's in the process of decommissioning and rehabilitation, and you've also got Rum Jungle up there in the Territory. And look, they've had a checkered history, and Rum Jungle especially is one of those examples where there's been a long period of a need to rehabilitate that site. However, the Territory remains open for exploration and development of mines. A lot of the good land up there is in the Alligators River region. You get good grade, but it's very, very difficult. You know, it's helicopter access and it can take time to get on ground from a community perspective. So, you know, that's a double-edged sword. Queensland's just very difficult at the moment. It's basically the same situation as WA. But South Australia is open and, you know, if you can find grade in South Australia, then it's a good place to look.
So the Palaszczuk government in Queensland's essentially got the same view as WA Labor government as well. Yeah.
Let's just touch on the sort of laws around nuclear power generation. So what is that looking like? Like there's essentially a ban as well, right?
Yeah, so
two separate things, aren't they?
Two separate things. And so federally, John Howard did introduce a ban on civilian power reactors as part of a sort of a last-minute negotiation with the Greens to federally regulate the radiation space.
And that was in his first term in 98, right?
And so that ban is reflected in Section 140A, I think, of the EPBC Act. And if anyone watched Q&A the other day, you know, it's Will Shackle, who's a young but leading sort of voice for nuclear in Australia, you know, held up the section. One section, very short, frankly, you can remove four words from that paragraph and you remove the ban on reactors. Now, what's interesting there is Senator Canavan, and I'm going to try and stay apolitical because people shouldn't think there's a
political issue. Bloody hard not to. Yeah. we always said we weren't going to be a political podcast, well, Jane.
And, you know, you don't want this to be a political issue. But so Senator Canavan put forward a bill to remove that ban on civilian power. And the Senate committee came back with a 100-page report after many months and basically said no. But the good thing about that 100-page report is they outline their reasons, and the reasons are absolute crap, honestly. I can go into them later. But what the federal government then did is put forward another bill which went through with no fanfare, just done, because they have to remove the ban on reactors in Australia to implement AUKUS. So instead of just saying, hey, let's get rid of the ban on civilian scale reactors above 50 megawatts, what they did is said, yes, we are going to remove the ban for the purposes of submarine propulsion only. So I don't understand from their ideology how they can bend themselves to say, yeah, we're totally anti-nuclear, but it's okay for propulsion. And similarly for the WA government, who say you can't mine uranium, yet we're really happy to have three nuclear reactors home-ported, SMRs effectively home-ported at Garden Island off Perth. Yeah, it's not safe to mine uranium, but hey, we're going to have nuclear reactors sitting off Perth.
And John, just to play devil's advocate and try and keep the podcast apolitical, the Liberals were in power for 9 or so years, I think from 13 to 22.
Yeah.
They may have had an opportunity, they had enough time in power to change the laws around this. Is it a factor of the momentum that's built around the last year that wasn't addressed during that time period?
Being apolitical, and I'm not giving the Liberals a free ride whatsoever. You had Scott Morrison parading around federal parliament with a bloody block of coal. I think previous policies of the Liberals were more around the questioning of whether or not net zero was important or not.
Yeah.
I think that's moved on now, and so why didn't they do it? Because I don't think they were there. Similarly, though, the nuclear renaissance globally has been a relatively recent phenomenon. It's been bubbling along, but it's really, really picked up in the last couple of years. And you've seen the amount of, you know, new reactors being built, reactor restarts, and also life extensions of existing reactors, just absolutely snowballing.
So Liberals have now, I think I've seen quotes that Liberals have become, and I think you said Liberals have become pro-nuclear. Is that Liberals across the border? We're talking Norway, separating WA, Queensland Liberals versus the federal Liberals. Who's getting behind it on the Liberal side?
It seems, although the formal policy is not out, that the federal Liberals will take a nuclear stance to the next election as their energy policy, and contrast that to Mr. Bowen's, you know, mass renewables policy. You know, from my perspective, there are certain concerns around, you know, obviously renewables have an important part to play. You have issues with grid stability when renewables get about 40% on your grid, which is where we're at the moment. So, the solution that the Liberals are saying is we'll put nuclear in for the rest. But it's that formal policy is not out there, so let's watch that space. You know, the WA Liberals are openly pro-uranium mining, yet they will say, well, we need to take into account the needs of our SWIS, so the Southwest Interconnected System, and that is not part of the national electricity market. So we're separate to the East Coast. And, you know, one of the things about the SWIS is it's a very small system with only a few gigawatts of demand. And so, you know, a standard big footprint nuclear plant that generates 3.6 gigawatts of power will not suit the SWIS. It's too big.
Yeah.
So the WA Liberals' policy is to say, let's look at those smaller reactors, SMRs, because they might fit, but big nuclear does not, because it's just it's way, 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 way bigger than the SWIS can handle.
Right. So, JD, how about we go through, we've read the news articles, all the arguments from the Labor side about why nuclear won't work.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
Australia.
You touched on what Mr. Bowen said, and I reckon the best way to do this is just to go through some of the common arguments against why nuclear won't work and just get your take on them.
Yep.
So
go ahead.
To start with, one of the questions was raised regarding a untrained workforce in relation to lack of IP really around handling it.
And so the nuclear naysayers will say Australia doesn't have a nuclear industry, right? Well, actually Australia's got a very highly regarded nuclear industry. It's small, but it's extremely well regulated. We have a national body, which is our PANSA. We have a national research institute, which is ANSTO, and we actually have a national body, which is in charge of anti-proliferation, which is ASNO. And all those bodies rank extremely highly in international regarding you know, how we do stuff. The second thing is we have a radiation industry at the moment to support our oil and gas and mining industries. So, you know, there's a lot of industries that do have background radiation associated with mineral sands, for example. Oil and gas has a lot of, you know, naturally occurring radioactive material. And so you have these facilities that have radiation safety cases. We do have all that stuff, but it does need to be built. But what I'd say to that is, you know, that's not a reason to keep a ban in place. That's an opportunity for future skilled resources. And at a time when people are worried about cost of living in their jobs, why not encourage an industry which will build highly paid jobs and will be diversified away from all the other industries out there, so it provide stability.
And another one, there isn't the infrastructure.
Yeah, so I guess the infrastructure is twofold.
That's talking about the power infrastructure.
So transmission lines, right? And this is not a simple debate, and there's a whole lot of stuff on Twitter with a few guys going back and forth on this point. So one of the issues around renewables, for example, you put a solar farm in the middle of nowhere, it needs a big transmission line to go to it, and that's expensive. Whereas having large-scale point-to-point transmission like coal stations, well, you could put a nuclear plant next to a coal station and piggyback off that existing transmission infrastructure. So there's some questions around there and how much you need to build out. The bigger the footprint of the new generator, you know, the more you might need to reinforce existing transmission lines. The second thing on infrastructure, though, is nuclear-specific infrastructure around nuclear value chains and transportation of nuclear materials, you know, is something that needs to be worked out. But it's something that, you know, for example, the UK does all the time, the US does all the time. And what does Australia do when we don't know the answer or we don't have an existing ready-to-go set of regulations? Well, we have history, just borrow it from the UK.
Yep.
And we implement that, we see what works overseas, and we bring best of practice to Australia.
And I think when you're talking about infrastructure, that was that in that – watch that YouTube video, that Aidan Morrison about the CSIRO report and saying they neglected to – they included all the big capital costs for transmission lines and everything, the infrastructure, the bulk infrastructure for the renewable side, and just – put them in as sunk costs.
Yeah, the way that gen cost is done, and you know, I don't know if it's by design or not. I'm not suggesting that someone in Chris Bowen's team asked them to do this, but they've taken 2030 as the date that they're going to assess costs. So not 2040, not 2023, 2030. And then they assume that there are these tens of billions of dollars of expenditure that is required to firm up renewables. So that's it's transmission and also batteries or firming infrastructure like pump hydro, like Snowy 2, and also the Aussie, the equivalent of Snowy 2 down in Tasmania. Tens and tens of billions of dollars. And they assume, that's going to be done before 2030, so we don't have to include that in the price when we're doing a comparison to nuclear. What they also do in that gen cost, and it's frankly obscene, is they assume a nuclear plant will last the same time frame as a wind turbine. So actually, wind turbines have a history of not lasting their 30 years, and nuclear plants are built to very high standards, tend to last 70, 80, 100 years. So the new designs are doing a lifespan of up to 100 years.
Well, I think the nuclear plants, what are these, Sigma 6 or whatever, how they the margin for error, I would assume it'd be like an aircraft for a nuclear plant.
Yeah.
Well bloody designed.
It is well, and so as you ratchet back the assumptions on lifespan for a nuclear, obviously it looks less attractive. The second thing they do is they put capacity factors on nuclear down at 60%, 66%. Now, a nuclear plant's capacity factor, the beauty about nuclear, if it's on, it's on. You know, you can have a capacity factor way higher, yet, and then they run capacity factors on wind and solar way higher than what you'd find in baseline. So there are ways where, and this is what the data scientists like Aidan Morrison and others are doing, is interrogating those models and saying, hang on, let's make sure it's fair from an assumptions perspective, and also let's make sure that you're capturing the whole of the cost to provide a system-wide cost. And that is actually not what GenCost does. Yet Mr. Bowen, and this is, you know, again, it's not something that's unique to Labor, politicians take part of something that will support their story and run with it. And frankly, if we tried to do that in the commercial sector, we'd get done for misleading and deceptive conduct, you know, under the Trade Practices Act. But you know, politicians are free to do that. And so you've seen a lot of criticism and discussion about the validity of the way that they're trying to use GenCost.
Jono, what do you make of the timing argument that these things take, you know, a new reactor takes 10 to 15 years and it's just too slow?
Yeah, it's fair point number one, you've got to consider that. You know, there are the saying is that the best time to invest in or start the nuclear process was 10 to 15 years ago. The second best time is today. You look at the Middle East where Saudi Arabia's putting in reactors.
Yeah, right? The UAE did a phenomenal job in about 10 years.
Yeah, less. And actually, well, they've got lots of solar and they've got lots of oil and gas as well. I think the regime does take a while to get in place, but it doesn't mean you should keep a ban in place. It also doesn't mean that renewables don't have their part. Absolutely they do. I think what we need to do is take an apolitical view on this, say we need to hit net zero as that is the outcome we're looking for. And why would we artificially stop even allowing anyone to consider a particular technology which is viewed globally as absolutely imperative? The United Nations says you will not hit net zero without nuclear, yet our wonderful energy minister, Mr. Bowen, has a view completely opposite, and I may have just published an article that sort of expands into that.
I'm sure his 10 years at Fairfield City Council put him in good stead for that. Now, this one is an interesting one, more so because I think it's completely wrong, but you'll be able to tell me. Nuclear is inflexible, so people discounting nuclear's ability to load follow around daily fluctuations in comparison to renewables.
So
that just seems
actually
a complete 180.
Yes. So I would say that it's outdated. We'll get into that. It's back to front. So renewables like solar may be able to displace nuclear during the day, right? But they cannot replace nuclear because they can't do it at night. So displace versus replace are different things. The second thing is, yes, older nuclear plants were less flexible, just like an older coal plant or even the older gas turbines. They kind of had to be on. You couldn't use them as peakers. Newer nuclear, so Gen 3 plus Gen 4, no, you can scale them on and off. So that is something where the nuclear, the anti-nuclear brigade is taking information which is outdated.
Yeah.
And also slightly backwards with respect to requiring flexibility in the grid. It is the renewables that drive the need for flexibility, not the other way around.
Oh, and the only way to do it with renewables is having some serious levels of baseload battery storage to create that stability.
Yes. It's basically massive amounts of storage in many different places around the country.
Because I think one of their arguments was I forget which minister said it, that it's always windy or sunny somewhere in the country. But
sure.
you can't just take the windy energy from WA and send it over.
Yeah, so let's have a transmission line from everywhere that it's always sunny to somewhere where
Twiggy might build one. He might bring the sun cable one over here.
Happy to talk about sun cable. Yep.
So, Johnny, you touched on Gen 3 and Gen 4, and that gets at another argument that people have, that the technology is not commercial yet. How do you rebut that one?
So you've got Gen 3 plus reactors in operation today. They're EPRs by Areva in France. Now, admittedly, they've had a checkered history with respect to buildability, constructability, so they've had some cost overruns. And Areva have brought out what's called EPR2, which is taking the learnings from the initial EPR reactors and actually making them more constructible. And so you're seeing those now come into the market. Westinghouse with their APR 1000s have had less of an issue with that and less of those cost overruns. But you've also got, you know, you've got the Chinese now building their own designs, admittedly that are based off Western technology, but they're domestic designs. They're building those at a record rate and they're building them on time and to what we understand on budget. India is building their own domestic designs now. Again, record rate, on time, relatively on budget, to the extent that you know about. So I think the whole the history of anti-nuclearism is driven by older technology, 1960s technology. You look back at Chernobyl. That's the same as saying, do you still drive a 1960s car? You don't. Are the safety features in your 2023 Tesla the same as a 1960s car? No, they're not.
The second last one I want to touch on, and I know this is one close to your heart, and I think it's super, super important to speak about it because it really speaks to the ideological view that a lot of the older generation have with regards to nuclear, and that's waste management. How do you rebut that?
Yeah, and nuclear waste has been a favourite of Hollywood. You know, it's the weapon of choice for the cartoonish villains. And it is The Simpsons. And you know what? The Simpsons is quoted in that Senate report that was just done to deny the removal of the ban as one of the main sources that Australians refer to for their views on nuclear is the freaking Simpsons, right? That is ridiculous. The Simpsons of the nuclear industry is what Borat did to Kazakhstan. You know, it's a terrible, terrible thing. You'd hope that the Australians are now getting a little bit smarter than that. But certainly, you know, the Simpsons have done the nuclear industry no favours. JD, you know I've got a bit of a background in rad waste and I got approved and built Australia's first commercially operated radioactive waste repository. In fact, the Southern Hemisphere's first commercially operated radioactive waste repository. It's here in WA. And we got that built at a time when uranium mining in WA was banned. Yet we've built a facility. It is world class, above world class. It is the best in the world at what it does. And it demonstrates that we handle rad waste in this country every day. There's rad waste that moves not only from medical isotopes but also from the oil and gas industry and the mining industries. And it is done under the current dangerous goods regime. It moves across Australia. There's very, very rarely an issue. I think earlier in the year, someone from one of the mining companies may have lost a capsule, which is a disused sealed radioactive source.
A company we'll talk about later on again.
That made worldwide news, but they found it. No big deal. You know, the amount of waste created from nuclear is very small in comparison, funnily enough, to renewables, which actually when you take in account of the life cycle of renewables, including mining and then the operational life of the assets, actually renewables creates a lot more waste. And it's waste that over time will become benign. So the difference to other mining wastes that are chemically hazardous. Chemically hazardous wastes generally are hazardous forever, whereas rad waste over time will decay. And, you know, it is something that just the community can get its head around. And it's the Dutch have made an art gallery out of their radioactive waste repository. You can literally go and look at modern art while standing next to nuclear waste. And it's that transparency. The community gets quite comfortable with it. You know, there's as much as Hollywood would like you to believe, there have not been instances where, you know, there have been issues with the handling of rad and nuclear waste. And there are great videos on YouTube, I don't know if you've seen them, about the safety that is designed into nuclear waste. You know, they drive over them with bloody trains, they smash into things, you know, and then the nuclear waste containers are fine. So I would say it's an issue which everyone can get very comfortable with. And, you know, man, I would prefer to live next to a nuclear facility than next to a coal plant, you know, from what comes out of that stack.
Mm. Agreed. The last issue I want to talk about is kind of the elephant in the room, and that's that these things are too expensive. And I want to frame the question in a particular way. Why do you think the government should stand in the way if private risk capital wants to undergo these projects to build new reactors and those sorts of things? Do you think that's right?
So no, I don't. And you may have read my latest article, which gets onto Chris Bowen's wording, which is it's a distraction. And what I've been pushing is, look, we're not saying that you have to build them. Remove the ban and let the market decide. Now, there is a whole lot of work, again, being done by GenCos and CSIRO, which suggests Mr. Bowen uses to say, oh, well, it's too expensive, so we won't remove the ban. That seems backward to me. And I've just sort of been talking about some of those assumptions that are used to suggest that nuclear is not competitive. I don't think they're clear-cut, let's say that. There's a lot of discussion about that. The second point to note is if it wasn't competitive, you wouldn't have all these hundreds of reactors being built and scheduled to be built around the world. So the nuclear renaissance is happening, and it is happening globally for a reason. Now, yes, conditions can change from country to country, but overall, nuclear is absolutely important part of the future generation mix. So I do not see a reason why questions about assumptions on a certain study that someone has done, which is not a real world thing, why that can be used to justify literally keeping a ban in place.
Okay, but why is we're talking about renewables versus nuclear? Like, why is it solar and wind versus nuclear at the moment? What, and in the context of if they're going to go for all these renewables, what is their baseload power going to be in their idea at the moment if it is not nuclear?
So massive storage through massive. So the view there is, you know, you have 80%+ renewables plus huge amounts of storage,
yeah,
and that storage be pumped hydro, as in Snowy 2, and some other assets, or chemical, like massive batteries.
Yeah, and what's the pros and cons to each situation?
Well, I'd say no one globally has made that work. Number one, you know. Who's phased out nuclear? Well, the Japanese did after Fukushima, but they've done a U-turn. Germany phased out their nuclear plants, although they're sitting on standby, they can be recommissioned. And look at where Germany is today from an energy security, energy cost, and energy carbon density perspective. They're an absolute basket case. So anyone who's turned their backs on nuclear either hasn't worked or they've done a U-turn.
Pardon the pun.
Boom. And for those, there's no other country that is sticking to such a high renewables target. In fact, you've seen Sweden come back and say, you know what, we're going to dial back our renewables targets and replace them with a fossil-free target. Because, you know, in my view, Australia is 20 years behind the rest of the world in a whole lot of stuff, and certainly in carbon and renewables, we were well behind Europe. And they've been trying on this stuff, and they're actually turning back to something which, yes, renewables are an important part of the mix, but they're not the only part of the solution.
There's one thing we touched on earlier, and that's the transmission system that we have in Australia. I've got a pretty low base of knowledge on this, so I'm keen to hear What is the sort of state of the transmission system across Australia, and how important is investment in that?
So I'm not going to be, I'm not going to pretend to be a fountain of knowledge on transmission.
You're just going to get the power there. They can sort all that.
No, so one of the issues that is purported to be around GenCos is that there is where you're going to distribute generation, and obviously renewables tend to be distributed either solar plants way out in the middle of the desert, wind is distributed, offshore wind, you need huge amounts of new transmission, and that transmission is expensive, number one. The second thing in the learnings, when you look at Canada, where Canada tried to do this and they've now gone back and actually are putting more nuclear back into their thinking, they said, funnily enough, that the one of the big issues for them was transmission lines. And not only the cost of transmission, but the amount of time it gets approved, because you've got to put these massive transmission corridors through thousands of landowners' land holdings, and that takes a lot of time. So Canada is a good analogy for Australia. Pretty similar land mass, pretty similar population size, and that population is centred in urban areas with, you know, that are dispersed, you know, long periods apart, so you need big transmission. They've both got big oil and gas and mining industries, the difference being that, and actually large renewables industries as well. But Canada has now decided to focus more on nuclear and actually wind back their renewables, because not only do they find that the transmission is hard, they're just finding that renewables can't provide that baseload.
There's a company we touched on earlier that had a bit of an incident, and also a mine, Ranger, that we touched on earlier. So Ranger's owned by ERA, which is 86% controlled by Rio Tinto.
Yep.
And Ranger was mined for, I think, about four decades and recently closed last year. It's been in the news quite a bit, and just this morning they announced that the rehab costs will materially exceed $2.2 billion. Mm-hmm. How important do you think it is for the state of nuclear and how it's viewed by society that Rio does a good job at rehabilitating this, or just managing the situation in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think the regime around financial assurance of mining projects generally is something that has come a long way since Ranger was implemented. You know, around in WA we've got the bonding system, situation in the territory when Ranger was opened was they didn't have to put up, you know, initial bonds or cash, whereas now you do. And I note that I told you I financed and did the approvals and built the Sandy Ridge facility in WA, which is the radioactive waste repository there. That has a fully funded financial assurance structure, the best in the world. And that is literally a superannuation fund for the project. It contributes money every period. That goes into a managed asset portfolio where you can invest in equities as well as debt. So it's not just risk-free earning interest. So just like your super fund massively increases value over time, that is the first instance of that kind of structure in Australia. It is something, when we put that in place, we had other governments from around the country asking WA to provide some papers on that, because, geez, that's really interesting. We can look to do that, because there are these sites, you know, and it's not just Ranger. You know, a lot of there's old copper assets and old gold mines and all sorts of polluted sites around Australia where these facilities were not bonded, not assured correctly. So I think it's unfair to say that's only a uranium issue, but that said, Range is a big asset.
Yeah.
And you know, it is thankful that Rio has the purse strings to fix that, and absolutely I believe they will. But it's something that, you know, we shouldn't judge the nuclear or the uranium industry on the basis of something started 40 years ago.
Now, I want to get on to in-situ recovery.
Yep.
And you spoke about at the start about mining it safely, and probably what everyone's perception of what mining uranium is going to look like versus what is actually happening. And I'll be fully honest, I wasn't too up on the in-situ recovery before today. But look, just first, and in the context of operations like Honeymoon coming online and Four Mile? Just explain what in-situ recovery of uranium is.
So go back 20 years and only about 10%, just less, of the global uranium market was at ISL. Now it's over 60, 65%. Now, the reason that's been the massive increase in the last 20 years is because uranium prices have been low, and so you've needed cheaper ways to mine uranium, and ISL is that. It's a lot cheaper than traditional mining.
And is it right to say the Kazakhs pioneered that?
The Kazakhs are where a huge increase in ISL has happened, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what you're doing essentially is it's not too dissimilar to drilling a hydro wells. You're putting down some drill holes. You're pumping fluid down there. You can either do a leach through an acid or an alkali, depending on the local conditions, and then you're sucking it back up. Through that leach period, the uranium's gone into solution. You can suck it up. Now, not every asset is ISL leachable, right? So you need to have a deposit which is amenable to in situ leaching. You also have to have an impermeable cap at the top, so water can't get in. And you actually have to have an impermeable base at the bottom so the material can't leach out into the bottom and contaminate the local environment.
Are they the main functions of what makes the deposit, or is there anything in the mineralogy that determines
and generally it's a paleochannel sediment-hosted deposit, yes. So,
okay.
So otherwise you have hard rock uranium, right? That's a different geological feature. That is, for example, where all the Athabasca Basin stuff is in Canada. It is extremely high grade.
Oh, well, looking at it this morning, looking at 300 to 500 parts per million for these leaching things, which is 0.03%. Yeah. And then these Canadian deposits, NextGen's what, 3%?
NextGen's got stuff 10 and 20%, right?
What's
Cigar
the other one?
Lake as well. Cigar
Lake was
15%. But the difference is they're 500 metres underground. You've got to physically mine it. You've got to dig down there. And so, you know, those ISL assets at 0.03 will get up before anything does on that hard rock.
And so, okay, how do you think, I guess, if you apply these following factors that are, you know, pertinent to in situ leaching, no drill and blast, minimal surface footprint, you mentioned workforce, like safely mining it, workforce protection. Those three factors, and also in the context, are levels of 300 to 500 ppm uranium, is that a hazard to the workforce?
From what I understand, the AEMWU's issues with uranium mining is they call it the next asbestos, right? So in my view, if you're actually avoiding anything which physically moves dirt and creates dust, I think you can't inhale the pregnant uranium liquid. I think you're absolutely.
I think it'd be advisable not to.
Yeah. But you're absolutely removing one of the risk factors that they're concerned about. The second thing is, you know, yes, once you mine the uranium, the pregnant liquor, you know, you create yellow cake, which will then get converted and then enriched to be a fuel source. We won't do conversion and we won't do enrichment in this country, or wouldn't expect, at least not for a while, but we will produce yellow cake. There's obviously radiation safety cases that need to be adhered to, but as there are, you know, hazardous safety cases for all sorts of shit that we use in the mining industry at the moment, like, you know, we use powdered arsenic, we use cyanide, and, you know, from a worker safety perspective, you don't see any immaterial difference.
Because this method looks like everything is fully contained within this system. It's not like it's flowing in front of your face.
No, that's right. But there is an end product, obviously, which needs to be bagged and shipped, and you need to be mindful of that. But it's not something that, you know, this country can't do. I think it's just ridiculous to assume that, you know, we can't safely handle these kind of materials, because we do it all the time.
So do you think, if you're going to talk about in situ leaching specifically, do you think those factors are going to have any influence on seeing a policy change for mining of uranium in WA and, say, Queensland?
Let's get on to the policy. You know, I guess one thing would be you could see a partial removal of ban to, say, ISL only.
What's your probability on that?
So my highest probability is that the policy gets changed when there's a change of government. That is most likely.
Yeah.
I think the second thing is that there can be change of policy when Mr. Cook could read the room, kind of like he read the room on the ridiculous heritage laws and the about face that was done on that. if he sees that indeed it is truly this mining ban is unpopular in the community, and it might cost him votes in the next election, you know, you could possibly see a move on that. And you know, you guys are aware we did release some polling as part of I sit on the Uranium Forum as part of the Minerals Council. We released some polling, and yeah, it shows you shouldn't be surprised. WA is a mining state, and this uranium mining ban is incredibly unpopular. So you know, we are absolutely ratcheting up, you know, the dialogue to just get people aware that there is a possibility to change this ban, and you know, this ban is costing the WA state a lot of money, and it's costing WA people a lot of jobs, and it's something that we can. The beauty of it is we can reverse that ban very quickly. It doesn't require legislation. It's a policy ban. It requires the signature of the mining minister.
How long are we sort of talking?
Well, so it's a policy ban, which literally can be done with the mining minister's signature. So it's not doesn't require new legislation, doesn't require control of the upper house or anything else like that. So that could be implemented quickly once the decision is made to do so. And also that means that Once there is a change of government, we all know the next election is March 25, that can be done quickly if the new government is a Liberal government.
And do you see it being a big enough issue for potential parties to run on this ban on uranium
mining?
Yeah,
so it's interesting because obviously federally the Liberal Party is running on an energy policy which includes nuclear, but they're two separate but related issues. I do think uranium mining in WA can be an election issue because you know, this policy or reversal of the policy ban would create thousands of new jobs, literally thousands of them. And they're not jobs that will be taken away from any other mine, new jobs that are highly paid, that come with R&D opportunities, that are a multiplier factor for the community and, you know, also actually, you know, additional money in terms of royalties into the WA government purse. There are very few policies I can think of that create that many new highly paying jobs very quickly. So I think absolutely as the state and the electorate worries about, you know, their mortgages and cost of living and surety about paying their bills, they would support a policy which will deliver, there's no question about it, delivers thousands of new jobs.
What does Australia look like? Let's say 30 years down the road and say nuclear gets up and it's all flying. What does a fully vertically integrated uranium society in Australia look like? We're talking mining reactors, but you say, look, it's got to be enriched and everything. Is there a possibility that could all stay within Australia or not?
So there is, I think it would be unlikely we'd undertake conversion and enrichment activities in Australia.
Just because of the cost, like same as iron ore and smelting.
Very few facilities globally that do that, and actually right now there is an excess in capacity. So I think that's probably unlikely, although who knows down the track. But, you know, you'll see where we have a world-leading uranium mining industry, which we should. We could have a civilian nuclear reactor industry providing, you know, baseload generation, R&D sitting off the back of that and increased an exporting of nuclear medicine. And we would have military in terms of the subs and a military industry to support that and you know, all the maintenance and everything that goes with it. I don't think you'll ever see, and nor should we equate that with Australia getting nuclear weapons. I mean, anyone who tries to suggest that is just alarmist. You know, there's no suggestion that we would go down that path. But finally, you know, we will have the perfect place for long-term disposal of our nuclear waste. But as I said before, that shouldn't worry anyone. So, yeah, we can have most of those parts of the nuclear value chain. It's just conversion and enrichment, yeah, it's probably not something that makes sense to have onshore.
I suppose now that you've framed it that way, I guess it probably does highlight how separate uranium mining is from nuclear power generation in Australia, considering the fact that we're mining, exporting and then re-importing the enriched uranium for the power generation.
And it's something that, you know, Australia is an exporter of uranium right now. Through Olympic Dam, and soon through Honeymoon. You know, we're just not where we should be. We have the world's largest resources of uranium globally. Anywhere. We are number one. We should be a number one producer.
Yeah, Olympic Dam's probably a big contributor to that because it's so fucking big. I think that's it. I think I looked at it's about 0.04%, I think.
Yeah, but we've got huge untapped resources and reserves and resources of uranium that we're just not there. I mean, Kazakhstan is clearly number one, but our resources are far bigger. And we're underexplored. Like, there's been bugger all uranium exploration in this country for the last 20 years. And it's something that, you know, there's a lot of potential there to increase further.
And with the potential policy changes, and it's going to have to change one day, even though they are separate issues, the mining and the power, but is it that going to be, it's all going to connect by a supply and demand thing eventually if there is the adoption. Like, if Australia wants nuclear power generation, there's going to have to be more uranium mined throughout the world, and Australia's going to have to contribute.
Well,
to
I think Australia's contribution to the overall uranium demand curve probably won't be that significant. But
what would it be like if a lot of things got up in Australia?
What, we might build 10 reactors, you know, 20 gigawatts.
Oh, no, but from the mining,
yeah,
like,
so
the yellow cake we supply.
Yeah, so there's no so Kazakhstan supplies 40% of the world's uranium at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, we have way more resources than Kazakhstan. We're also probably, you know, more Western-leaning, and when you talk about bifurcation of the market and security of supply, you know, I'm sure the Americans would prefer to buy Australian uranium than they would Kaz. Mm. Kazakhstan, though, is ideally located between China and the EU, two of the largest markets. So they've got some advantages there. But, you know, there's no reason why we can't be the world's largest producer of uranium, or at least one of the largest, and we're not at the moment. And it's something that, you know, if reactors were to get up in Australia, it would be a very strange situation where reactors were in Australia and we couldn't mine uranium. But it can happen the other way. Like, yeah, uranium mining can expand and still not have reactors in Australia for many reasons. It may be that, you know, hey, we lift the reactor ban in Australia and for some reason reactors aren't built here. But I think we should lift the ban and let the market decide, see what it delivers.
Pretty sensational.
Awesome. I think we're all much the wiser about
bloody hell. Hey, this will be, I'm sure. And now anything uranium pops up, you're now our fucking go-to guy, Jono. We'll have you again sometime. I'm hoping that the money miners really enjoyed this and it gets out there.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting and it's going to really heat up. This thing, and it already is.
And I reckon, you know, West Australians are absolutely on it. You know, we love mining over here. And let's be a world leader in uranium.
Well, I suppose we probably digressed a bit onto power generation, but yeah, as we said, the focus is seeing if this WA mining of uranium ban will be lifted one day.
And to play on words, there's a lot of money in a uranium mine, especially at the moment. So let's get it going.
Cheers, Jono. Right. Oh, geez, we better thank the sponsors, JD.
Yep, K-Drill, Anytime Exploration Services.
JP Search, recruiting for not uranium jobs, but look, they could diversify if possible.
They could. Terra Capital.
Terra Capital. Love Terra, yet love uranium.
They do.
Terra are big uranium fans. And SMEC Power and Technology, the electrical gurus in the mining industry.
Beautiful. Thanks guys. Support.
Cheers, money miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.